I'd like to call to order the House Judiciary, excuse me, Policy and Finance Committee. Clerk, take the roll.
Representative Smith?
Here.
Representative Shemansky?
Here.
Representative Johnson is excused. Representative Anderson?
Here.
Representative Champion?
Here.
Representative Cornish? Representative Gruenhagen?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Creasel?
Here.
Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh is excused. Representative Liebling? Representative Mazarol?
Here.
Representative Moline?
Here.
Representative Schumacher?
Here.
Representative Vogel?
Here.
Representative Wardlow?
Chair notes that we do have a quorum. First item would be consideration of the minutes. May I have a motion on that?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes of March 17, 2011. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Members, the chair is going to make a minor revision to our plans today, and rather than offer the delete all amendment to House File 440, I'm going to walk through the amendment to explain each article, and then I'm going to ask the fiscal analyst to further explain the details of the appropriations afterwards. I'll open the committee to public testimony on each article, and during testimony, members, you're invited to ask questions as they come up. At the conclusion of each witness. With today's testimony and discussion is concluded, we'll then continue to lay over House File 440 until Thursday, at which time I'll offer the delete all amendment and the committee will consider any additional amendments. House File 5 faces a $5 billion shortfall between expected revenue growth and expected growth in government spending. To close this gap, most fiscal committees need to do more with less, and some will simply do less with less. This committee, however, has been spared any cuts to our projected baseline budget through recognition that the government functions and services funded through this committee are core and essential. We could simply take the easy route and put in law the projected baseline left by the previous legislature, or we can mean what we say in funding our priorities within our baseline target. With all due respect to some of my colleagues, the projected baseline represents the priorities of the previous legislature, to which we are not compelled to follow. To borrow from Thomas Jefferson, no legislature shall bind the hands of a future legislature. In that spirit, we take the current projected baseline as a guide, but it is not inviolate. Representative Shemansky.
The purpose of this committee in its fiscal responsibilities is to examine each appropriation and expect each agency in the courts to justify not only their requests for funds, but to justify their spending of funds already appropriated, to demonstrate not only to this legislature, but to the public, that they respect the monies provided by taxpayers. And let us be reminded that we hold the taxpayers' money in trust with the expectation that these funds will be spent wisely. The money held by the state does not then become the government's money. It remains the property of the people. While we remain liable for its value in promoting, as stated in our state constitution, the security, benefit, and protection of the people in whom all political power is inherent. This budget before you is not a perfect solution, but it represents our commitment and a statement by this committee that we will fund our priorities and the third branch of government. This bill funds core government function and essential services, and there is no doubt that our judicial courts are by definition a core government function, and our public defenders provide an essential service mandated by our Constitution and common sensibilities of justice. I have said, and I believe, the courts have been a model of innovation in leading the way toward greater efficiency and setting an example for the other branches and agencies of government. When the courts tell us that they are at the breaking point, that failing to provide additional funds means additional cuts, we are left with two choices. We can either believe them or disregard them. From their record, I am inclined to believe the courts have done all that is reasonably expected in trimming their operations. To accomplish this, we make every very difficult choices in shifting funds within our baseline budget to provide additional funds to the courts to maintain court operations in handling criminal cases that help keep our streets and neighborhoods safe. The right to a speedy trial and the prompt administration of justice are fundamental rights of all citizens, not just those accused of a crime. We cannot allow those properly found guilty of crimes against our citizens to be released back onto the streets because we failed to provide the courts with the resources that they need to fulfill their constitutional obligations. Civil Legal Services will see a reduction in general fund appropriation to shift resources directly into the courts and spare any further reductions to public defenders. This is not to say that Civil Legal Services do not provide an important function, but they are not a state agency, and their funding is ultimately grant funding, which nobody should presume is without limit or reduction. The mission of legal aid is to help those less fortunate through the civil legal system, but the courts are the backbone of that legal system and must remain strong to serve all who present their case. We also include language to limit state resources to state-related matters, prevent the use of these resources to sue the state or federal government or lobby for or against public policy measures. To avoid cutting deeply into civil legal services, reductions are made to the projected baseline of the newly created Guardian Ad Litem Board and shifting some of their resources into the court system they serve. They will be given the resources they need to carry out their statutory mission to provide guardian ad litem services to victims of abuse and neglect, but the courts will need to be responsible and judicious in requesting appointments under the permissive statute for marriage dissolution and other family law situations where the safety and security of the child is not directly in peril. This bill carries a charge that we know the guardian ad litem already understand, and that is the mission to ensure that statutorily mandated cases of abuse and neglect are given priority over permissive court appointments. With additional funding for the courts comes additional scrutiny on good conduct by the judges entrusted to administer justice. Therefore, we also provide a limited increase in funding for the Board of Judicial Standards to ensure that they have the resources they need to accomplish their mission in helping guard the integrity of our court system. We have seen a recent spike in judicial misconduct cases that is very troubling, and we must enforce the message and the mission that we expect our judges to live up to the higher standards demanded of their position and their authority. The Tax Court and Sentencing Guidelines Commission will be maintained in their current projected baseline level with no increase or decrease. The request for additional funds by the Tax Court is denied in this recommendation. The Tax Court, like most every other state agency, will have to figure out how to make their current budget work while still providing their statutorily mandated services to the taxpayers of Minnesota. And on that point, it is the opinion of the chair that the Tax Court erred in shutting its doors in the previous fiscal year, and I strongly urge the court to find an alternative to completely shutting down operations during this fiscal year. If the court is unable to find a means by which to operate within their projected baseline appropriation, they are instructed through this bill to remain open whenever executive branch agencies are open for regular business. If unpaid leave is the only solution, then we strongly recommend that the court take advantage of having three judges and stagger their leave to have at least one judge still hearing and processing cases. I also invite the court to come to this committee with ideas on how to make their operation more efficient to help them operate within their means. The Public Defense Board provides a constitutionally mandated service designed by our founders to protect the rights of the innocent in guarding against manipulation of the state through the court system. The right to access effective counsel is sometimes all that stands between the citizen and the unjust administration of justice. It is our hope to see the public defenders provided with additional funding to carry out their core mission in upholding our constitutional ideals and protecting against the heavy hand of government. However, the reality of our baseline budget is that to provide the public defenders with additional general fund resources would require even deeper reduction to civil legal services and guardian ad litem. It is of little comfort that the additional resources come only from the extension of the attorney registration fee. To help ensure that the public defender services are going to those intended, the public defense corporations will be instructed with clarifying language that funds for the public defense corporations will be used in the same manner as required by the law for the public defense board. No portion of our baseline was left unexamined. To help fund the increase to the Board of Judicial Standards, we will ask the Uniform Laws Commission to take what I hope will be a temporary reduction in funding. I appreciate that the Commission is already behind on its dues to the national organization, and this committee, through this bill, will direct the Uniform Laws Commission to prioritize their appropriation to continue making a good faith effort to paying their dues over attending national meetings. And while we agree the Commission has an important function, the state of Minnesota will not grind to a halt if their work is interrupted for a couple of years. It is unfortunate that the courts have been put in this situation, but as we heard in testimony to this committee, in fully funding the hold harmless request of the courts, they can stop the bleeding and stabilize the system. But we urge the court system to make clear to the Minnesota Management and Budget Agency that the projected increase in benefit payments must be shared with the employees to help put our money into actual operations and not just the compensation package. To that end, we are instructing the courts to study the option of leaving the State Employee Insurance Group plan and shopping for a better deal on the open market that provides benefits comparable to the private sector at a competitive rate, while also giving the courts more control in the balance between employer and employee contributions toward those benefits. Ultimately, it is our hope that these reductions are temporary and can be restored. These decisions are not made lightly, and we pledge to continue to advocate for more funding across judicial agencies. Our responsibilities here, though, go well beyond simply filling numbers into a spreadsheet, but must also include the reforms to aid in the system and promote accountability and cost control. We therefore have included a number of riders and reforms aimed at that purpose. For the past 2 years, the courts and the public defenders have voluntarily undertaken a salary freeze with their negotiating partners representing the employees. Unfortunately, the current fiscal situation requires that to continue. Therefore, this budget will instruct the courts, agencies, commissions, and boards funded by this appropriation to impose or otherwise maintain a freeze on salaries and compensation under their control for the next 2 years. To control transportation line items, the mileage reimbursements will be capped at 51 cents per mile for the next 2 years. These are not trivial expenses, and the uncertainty of gasoline prices could very well see the IRS allowance increase, which would add to the cost to the state if a cap is not in place. In those cases where the federal mileage rate may exceed the capped rate, the Internal Revenue Service allows employees to claim the difference as a deduction on their income tax forms. Article 2 of the bill includes portions of House File 440 as introduced and House File 1023 as introduced. To help improve court efficiency and save taxpayers' time, Sections 1, 2, and 3 clarify the requirement on the placement of the front license plate, modifying the procedure for providing proof of insurance to the courts to clear a lack of insurance citation, and clarifying that a person must pay a surcharge for a diversion program, continuance without prosecution, continuance for dismissal or stay of adjudication. It is estimated by the courts that Sections 1 and 2 will save the court resources, and Section 3 will help ensure that the required surcharges are assessed. Section 4 grants the courts more discretion in ordering fees or reimbursements with informal pauperous waivers, allowing civil litigants to proceed without prepayment of fees, costs, or securities of cost. Nothing, however, changes the eligibility for the waiver or requires the court to order a cost on a person the court determines is unable to pay. Article 3, H.F. 987 and H.F. 988, dealing with public defender representation, eligibility, and reimbursements. Key provisions previously heard by this committee include: requires the court to inquire if the prosecutor intends to certify the case as a petty misdemeanor, which then removes any requirement for a public defender appointment. Clarifies that only those defendants with a statutory right to a public defender may request the public defender. This will limit the court in using public defenders in civil law matters. Sets income eligibility guidelines in statute for the appointment of a public defender, while preserving the constitutional requirement allowing judges to step outside strict income guidelines in appointing a public defender to defendants unable to afford effective representation. Requires the courts to make a determination of financial eligibility using a standard financial statement provided by the Public Defense Board, and lifts the prohibition on requiring the public defenders to aid in the financial inquiry to determine eligibility. Clarifies language instructing the courts to not appoint a public defender to a defendant that is financially able to retain counsel but refuses to do so, refuses to execute the financial statement or provide financial information, or waives appointment of a public defender. Clarifies that the chief appellate public defender represents defendants seeking an appeal, and the district public defender represents all other statutory cases. Adds language requiring a defendant who is or becomes able to make partial payments to reimburse the state for the cost of the public defender, and repeals the statutory requirement that reimbursement funds must be used for part-time public defender overhead.
Go ahead.
Okay. Article 4 is H.F. 556 on sexually exploited youth, approved by the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee and heard by the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. This bill is an important step in fighting the tragedy of juvenile prostitution and child sex trafficking. No longer will we treat the victim of child sexual exploitation as criminals, but we will give them the support and protection they need. When a 15-year-old runs away from home to escape domestic abuse or neglect, or simply rebels and becomes ensnared in child prostitution, it begins a vicious cycle of abuse where the juvenile feels trapped by both the shame of prostitution and the fear of being treated as a criminal. This will break that cycle and extend vital protections to some of our most vulnerable citizens suffering sexual exploitation and degrading humiliation, not to mention inherent dangers to both mental state and physical well-being. Specifically, Article 4 provides that a juvenile cannot be prosecuted for committing a prostitution offense under the Delinquency Code. These juveniles and others would fall under the definition of sexually exploited youth as a child in need of protection or services. This article also makes changes to a penalty assessment currently imposed on adult patrons by increasing and amending the distribution of the assessment. It also directs the Department of Public Safety to develop a statewide victim services model for sexually exploited youth if funding is provided through a private gift, and makes changes to the structure and definitions used in prostitution crimes. H.F. 440, as amended, funds our courts, makes key reforms, and protects juvenile victims of sexual exploitation. We have said at the beginning that this is not a perfect solution, but it does fund our priorities with the limited resources we have in promoting public safety and the administration of justice.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. At this time, I'd like to ask the fiscal analyst to walk through the numbers with a little more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You should all have the spreadsheet in your packet. It's two pages. And just to orient you to this again, all of the accounts that the committee has jurisdiction over are listed in here. And the columns, the first columns are the February forecast for the biennium 2012 and 13. This is when we refer to the base. This is these are the base numbers. And then the governor's recommendations are in the next, the middle section of columns. And then the columns all the way over to the right are the House recommendations. And so these, the numbers in the House recommendation columns, these are what reflect the DE2 amendment for House File 440 that Representative Schmansky just went over. The 2010 and 11 base, just to give you some reference, the total for the Judiciary Committee accounts is about $735 million. And then the base for the current biennium that we're budgeting for was $726.8 million. That is also the target that the committee was given to reach for all these accounts. So the way that the bill does that, I'll just point out a few of the changes. The courts asked for some increases, and the governor recommended giving those increases, and they were for increase in funding things like health care costs, pension costs, and in this bill, those increases were also granted. What that amounts to is about $6.7 million, and so those are increases for the Supreme Court, for the Court of Appeals, and for the district courts. And any of those changes you can see on, it's a really light shading, but on line 7, on lines 24, and on line 33, that's where these increases are show up on the spreadsheet. And then there was one other increase. It was for the Board of Judicial Standards. That is the amount for the biennium total. It's about $28,000. That's on the second page, and that is on line 64. And so that was also a thing that the governor recommended in his budget as well, and that was full funding to restore to have full funding restored for investigations and hearings. And then the other changes from the base were some reductions, and that the first one you'll see on line 14, this is for civil legal services, and it's $1 million in 2012 and then $3 million in 2013. And then the guardian ad litem board is on line 41, and so that for the biennium totals about $2.7 million. And then the one other reduction is for Uniform Laws Commission, and that is on the second page, and that's on line 56, and that reduction is $19,000 per year. And I think that's everything. And again, all of these numbers on the spreadsheet are general fund, and I can answer any questions. I hope I didn't go through that too quickly.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you show me where on the spreadsheet the fee increases that are in the bill would show up on the spreadsheet?
We, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I didn't include any of the fee increases on the spreadsheet. We didn't, I think you're referring to the recovery, the way that the courts can recover more fees. Is that correct? Or?
Well, there's actually three places where there are fees in the bill. And one is the new fee on the informa pauperis. One is the you can't waive the public defender fee of less than $100. And the third fee, if you give me just one second, is the increase in now diversion. Folks who went to diversion used to pay the fee if they successfully completed, and now there's the fee on everyone that goes to diversion.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I did not include those fees on the spreadsheet. I just stuck to the general funds, but I can try to put that together. For some of them, it was hard for the courts to determine just how much would be brought in by some of those changes, but I will work on that and get that back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to the cuts that are in your budget, the State Government Finance Committee received a lump sum cut that they are supposed to spread out across all agencies and entities in addition to their budget target. How much of that cut will the State Government Finance Committee be doing in your bill or your areas?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, can you repeat the question?
Certainly. It was brought to our attention on the House floor that the State Government Finance Committee was given two cut numbers. One was what they were supposed to cut within their own agency, and one that they are supposed to cut in all other agencies across all of the budget items. So how much of the budget target that's in the state government finance area will be going to the judiciary side of the budget cuts that will be made by this committee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's a good question. I don't know the exact amount. Those numbers will be tracked on the state government spreadsheet, but I can I'll find out what that is for you as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that it would be very important for the folks that are that care about this area of the budget to pay attention to the cuts that are coming to this area of government through the state government finance bills rather than through this committee as well.
All right, at this time, we're going to move to some testimony. I'd like to call Suzanne Allegro and Judge Leslie Metzen with the Guardian Ad Litem Board.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Leslie Metzen, currently serving as chair of the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. And I appreciate the chance on this short notice to address all of you. I got a call yesterday after your targets came out, and I just have to say, in all honesty, I was shocked. We really anticipated that we would be treated the same as the rest of the judicial branch. It was just last year that you created a separate governing board for the Guardian Ad Litem program for a whole host of probably really good policy reasons. We actually convened our first meeting in October, and we're really just putting our toes into the waters of independence as an organization. I really do not believe that this model would have been suggested if the idea was that this standalone program in the judicial branch, which is where we remain, would absorb all of the cuts that are coming to the judicial branch. Because as I understand it, basically the rest of the branch is being held pretty harmless. If you had not created us as a separate entity, the cuts that you are required to make, and you know, frankly, we all anticipated that some cuts would be coming our way, but the cut that is on our plate now would have been absorbed by the entire branch. And while it would be significant to everybody, it would never have been suggested in the branch that the Guardian Ad Litem program alone absorbed those cuts. So the roughly $2.4 million, as I understand it, in our $12 million budget is huge. Whereas if it had been, could be spread out over the entire branch, which has a budget something around $100 million, it would certainly be easier to swallow. And again, part of the reason that the Guardian Ad Litem Board and our functions remained in the judicial branch is that we had hoped that we would be treated in the same way as the rest of the branch. We're also devastated by these cuts, or would be, because of our critical function in representing the most vulnerable of participants in the legal system, the abused and neglected children of the state of Minnesota. their interests will be compromised by the cuts that have been imposed upon us. Children who come into court are there not because of their own choosing. The rest of the litigants in the process, by and large, are there because either they're criminals who committed some offense and they need to be there, or they're litigants who come voluntarily to the court. But the kids that we represent are not there voluntarily. They're there because of what others have done to them. They've been physically abused, they've been sexually abused, they've been neglected, or they're the children of divorce. Our role in advocating for those children in juvenile courts is critical to their well-being. We push for timeliness and permanency, and we're always promoting the best interests of the children. As you might know, I was a judge for 23 years in Dakota County, and when I was in juvenile court, first of all, I want to tell you that's the toughest work that a judge does, absolutely, bar any other cases. And a judge's decisions are only as wise as the information that's relevant to a particular decision that comes to the judge. In CHIPS courts, you often have parents that are at war with each other, their lawyers are warring with each other. Child Protection Services is there, and they certainly care about the welfare of children, but they've got budget issues that they have to deal with. And you can look up in the CHIPS courtroom, and you'll see a little kid sitting there, the kid who is the subject of the proceeding. They're usually fidgeting, sometimes they're crying, they're worried about what's going to happen to them next. And the guardian ad litem in the courtroom is often the only voice of calm, objectivity, reason, and focused on what's in the best, truly best interest for that child at that particular moment. If we're made to absorb these cuts, I just want you to be aware that the reality is that the wheels of justice for these children will be dramatically slowed, and the caseloads will be overwhelming for the guardians that we're able to maintain. We will slide back, I'm afraid, to the days when children languished in foster care because no one was there to keep things on track and to argue on their behalf. All those adults in the who are litigants and who are coming into the courts, they can afford to wait. The kids cannot afford to wait. Guardian ad litems throughout the state play a critical supporting role to every single judge who has to decide the fate of our children. As part of the judicial branch, funding of the CHIPS courts, particularly in the judicial branch, has received the highest priority since the leadership of Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz. And she instituted the Children's Justice Initiative, which was, I think, her greatest lasting legacy. She rightly recognized that the input of a guardian ad litem for every single child was essential. And she made that her goal, and we accomplished that goal. Every kid who appears in CHIPS court now does have a guardian ad litem. But the targets that you've set for us here and the implications of those cuts will directly impact the welfare of abused and neglected children, the children that our guardian ad litem serve. And I would respectfully ask, as you continue your deliberations, to reconsider this. I heard somebody say once that the Maasai tribe in Africa has a way of greeting one another, and their way of greeting each other is to ask, how are the children? And I think that that's a question, it's a greeting that maybe we should consider adopting here. How are the children? Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Representative
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. If I want to ask questions about the guardian ad litem board, but I want to ask them of the courts who used to have them, when would the appropriate time be for me to ask those questions?
right now.
Ms. Dosell isn't at the table.
Do you have me to leave?
No.
I'm bringing my wingman with me.
All right. Let me apologize to you, Ms. Dosell, before I start these questionings. But, Mr. Chair, I carried this bill, and so I feel some personal responsibility here. So, Ms. Dosell, can you tell me, will the courts continue to appoint guardian ad litems that the guardian ad litem board cannot provide with these budget cuts?
Ms. Dosell.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I think I'm going to defer to my fellow judges here who are going to be in the situation of making those decisions. So perhaps starting with Judge Dave.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Knutson. I'm a district court judge down in the 1st Judicial District in Dakota County. First of all, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say a few words. We recognize the historic budget challenges required of these very difficult choices and the prioritizations that you've had to make. And just on behalf of the judicial branch, I'm also a member of the judicial council that operates the judicial branch. And on behalf of the council and the Chief Justice, we want to thank you for your funding recommendation to the judicial branch. This will enable us to continue to be forward-looking, to work on initiatives that we believe in the long run will make our justice system better and perhaps more accessible, more efficient, more effective and sustainable as competition for limited government funding increases make it difficult for all of us in the future. So I just want to start with that. And then Representative Hillstrom, with respect to the question, we certainly will continue to appoint guardians ad litem in certainly the CHIPS cases as their budget allows. We will most likely reduce the number of appointees, guardian ad litem appointments, in cases that are not mandatory. So, like family law, custody evaluations, those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in the event that there is not a guardian ad litem available through the board in one of these mandatory cases, based on these cuts, will you be assessing the counties to pay for the guardian ad litem services, as happened with the public defender's office?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I'm Jim Swenson. I'm the chief judge in the 4th Judicial District. I don't anticipate that that's going to happen. That's just my best response. I think that we will do our very best to make sure that guardians are appointed in the limited circumstances required, and we'll be taking a look at it as the year unfolds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you oppose language prohibiting the courts from assessing the counties for guardian ad litem charges that are not funded by the state?
Judge Swenson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. I think that's a policy question for you to decide. We implement the policy decisions you make, and as I said before, we're going to make our best efforts to appoint guardians in all the cases that are required, and I'm optimistic that we'll be able to do so.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dosell, now I'm going to quote you when I carried the bill, and I just want to put this on the record, and you just correct me if you think that this is incorrect. Members, when I carried this bill for the judicial branch, the statement on the Finance Committee on April 8th to this committee was, this program should not receive a cut despite the rest of the cut to the judicial branch to help transition the board. It was also stated, I want to make sure I have my dates correct, March 25th to the Public Safety Finance Division.
This kind of programs involve cases that endanger the most emotion of any kind, engender the most emotion of any kind that we handle, with high conflict parties that may stand to lose their children, and they need the maximum amount of training and oversight and supervision, and that is not possible with independent contractors. So we are moving to that now as a strategy to improve the quality and productivities of our guardian ad litems. And that is not yet done and will be part of the efficiencies that we realize. Basically, Ms. Dosell, do you believe that we, you and I, portrayed to this committee that by actually making the Guardian Litem Board an outside entity in which we funded and did not give them the cut, that we were actually going to improve the quality and productivity of the program and actually realize efficiencies in the court system?
Ms. Dosell.
Mr. Chair and Madam Representative Hillstrom, certainly that's, you're quoting exactly what I said. The time in 2010 when we are moving this program over to an independent board, the court did make the decision, the Judicial Council made the decision that no cut should be assessed against the board, even though we took cuts in other places to absorb the budget reduction, the base budget reduction that we had, in order to give that board its best chance to establish itself. That's absolutely true.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you believe that these cuts, as proposed in this bill, will allow this board to do as the Judicial Council requested at the time that I carried this bill?
Ms. Dosell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, obviously what this requires, this cut would require the board to prioritize the mandated cases that are required, and we have to do less in the non-mandated area. Over its lifetime, the GAL program had to do that when it didn't have sufficient resources. And so this would be a policy decision for this committee and this legislature to determine how best to do that. But that, as I understand, from our history with this program and from the testimony of Ms. Allegro before this committee, is how that would be handled.
Mr. Chair, final question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dosell, and to the Judicial Council, would you oppose me repealing the statute I carried by which I moved the Guardian Ad Litem program outside the courts?
Judge Knudsen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, absolutely. That decision was made for a number of reasons, most importantly, as you well know, because of an inherent conflict of interest between the branch operating, controlling the Guardians Ad Litem and in their appointments and their funding and everything else, and the judicial branch being involved in the adjudicative function that we have and having those people appear as parties before us in court. So it would be imperative that we leave it as you so wisely passed last year. So,
Mr. Chair, just a final statement, not a question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Had I known this was the result, I would not have agreed to carry it.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming today, judges, and Sue Dosell. And question for you, probably to Judge Knudsen or one of the judges. Currently for the Guardian Ad Litem program in the family law area, what are the percentage of this budget, of the Guardian Ad Litem budget, goes towards paying for Guardian Ad Litems for family law cases where there is no instances of abuse or neglect in those cases? And I did request this data from the Guardian Ad Litem people a while ago.
Identify yourself and proceed.
I'm Susanna Legro, Program Administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem Board, and Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's about, at this point, about 70% of the cases are mandated and about 30% are what we term the permissive appointment.
Is that just in family, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Anderson.
Is that just for family law cases?
30% is primarily family cases.
Of the total, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Batters.
Of the total budget, your guardian ad litem budget, only 30% goes to family law cases?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, the total percent of cases, permissive cases is 30%, and of the 30%, probably primarily they are family law cases. We've not done the work as far as breaking down the budget, as far as what actual budget amounts go into the mandated versus the permissive.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. At this time, the chair will call Jerry Lane with Mid-Minnesota Civil Legal. I'm sorry. Ms. Allegra.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention one other thing on the permissive cases so that the committee is aware of it. We do, in those cases, we do assess fees against the parties if they do have the ability to pay. And in order to provide services to as many of the many of the children as possible, the board at the last meeting did increase the fees, which had not been increased since 2003.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Lane with Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. This is Gary Hurd with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. We appreciate the very difficult circumstances that you and this committee face. At the same time, I know that you and the members will understand our concerns. Going into the current legislative session, Civil Legal Services was already the most underfunded component of the justice system, trying to provide services to the most vulnerable of your constituents. Legal Services staff were already the most underpaid in the justice system, and Civil Legal Services was already slated to take a funding hit in the state IALTA program equivalent to a 14% appropriation cut. As we mentioned in our committee testimony, a number of functions Civil Legal Services performs make the justice system work better and save the taxpayers money. That is why all the components of the system recognize the need to have all the legs of that stool strong. That's also why there has not been a history over the past 30 years of trying to shore up one part of the system by reducing support for another part. I know you understand the impact of these cuts that are proposed in terms of increased homelessness, domestic violence, victimization of vulnerable seniors, and so on. I make these points, Mr. Chairman, not because I expect you to change your mind this morning, although I certainly would not object if you decided a smaller reduction was achievable. I know you have thought long and hard about these issues, and I don't envy you. I raise these issues because this year, especially, the process of adopting a budget may well be a long one, the outcome of which is difficult to predict. I know there are political differences of opinion about the best way to balance the state's budget, and I do not aspire to get caught in a crossfire over those differences. But it is possible that as this process moves forward, you might find yourself in the position of having some more resources available. And if that were to happen, I would ask you to give a high priority to restoring the resources lost to the clients of legal services in this proposed budget. In doing so, you would be in the fortunate position of being able to help the Minnesotans least able to fend for themselves and help the taxpayers at the same time. I'd like to touch just briefly on the proposed rider language that would affect how funds could be used by civil legal services providers. I realize that there are some concerns underlying the rider language, but I think the language as drafted would have some consequences that may be unintended and that would be harmful to the taxpayers of Minnesota. I know there isn't time this morning for an extended discussion of that. I would just note as one example, for example, the fact that the draft language would preclude the use of funds to do ordinary Social Security disability and SSI appeals for constituents who are too disabled to work. That representation produces enormous benefits to state and local government, easing the burden on tax-supported services far in excess of the cost of representation. What I would ask, Mr. Chairman, is that we have an opportunity to sit down with you and staff after this morning and see if we could find some language that responds to your concerns without some of the negative consequences that would flow from the draft language. Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on Article 1? Article 2. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question also of the judges regarding Article 1 and some language on line 2.1.
2. What?
2.1. The judicial and referee vacancies language, Mr. Chair. Sorry, Mr. Chair, 2.10. Stated judicial referee vacancies.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, could you please tell me what impact this might have? We heard testimony that the judicial branch needs 20 additional judges, and this language would not permit you to certify any judicial or referee vacancies until you did this assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, again, I'm Jim Swenson, Chief Judge of the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin. We've been working under this same scenario for 2 years now, and that has not been an impediment to us in the 4th. We have many, many referees and subordinate judicial officers, and we're always working to expand that use.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your area, that's not an issue. Is it an issue in greater Minnesota or any other judicial districts? And then how many vacancies are currently open in the judicial branch?
Justice Swenson.
I think it's more problematic in outstate Minnesota, and we're working on that from a judicial council perspective on how we can figure out the critical mass in smaller districts in order to warrant the use of referees and subordinate judicial officers, and that's something we're talking about on a regular basis. I think this is more problematical outstate Minnesota. From a conceptual standpoint, I don't know in actuality whether it's been problematic because I don't get involved in certifying those outstate positions. But we have venue issues and things like that that we would have to deal with on a statewide basis. I don't know if Judge Knuthen knows the number of vacancies we have right now across the state. Isn't it something in the range of 8?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, I believe we have a 6 or 7 vacancies at this time, and I think this language has been used for quite some time, and not just in the last 2 or 3 years, but I've seen this language, I think when I was in the Senate, was floating around, and we've used it in the past. And from the first judicial district, we've got some rural counties, the half a judge county, a one judge county, a two judge county, and that's the advantage of working in a judicial district where we feel like we're all part of a team and we can send folks out to those other areas on a daily basis to handle those calendars if we get into a situation where that is where the vacancy might be. But the other thing we're looking at, because this isn't, the judicial branch recognizes that this isn't just an issue for this biennium, but it's ongoing, and how do we continue to operate and meet our constitutional and statutory obligations in a diminished revenue kind of an environment. So we're looking at adjunct judicial officers, we're looking at volunteer attorneys to come in and conduct conciliation court hearings to relieve some of the pressure. So we're examining a lot of things, and I don't think this language is going to hurt us all, to hurt the judicial branch, since we've been operating under this for at least the last 2 years, for sure.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final question then. So when the testimony has been given by the judicial branch that they need 20 additional judges, do they need 20 above the 8 that are vacant, or do they need to really fill the 8 and they really only need 12 more?
Representative Hillstrom, Chairman, that's 20 above the current vacancies. That was based upon the weighted caseload study that we started in the spring of 2009. And what that says is that in order to do our cases in a way that is appropriate and best delivers services, we need more people to do that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking at the language of this provision and the next one, I wonder about the legality of these, and I'd like the judges to comment on that. The Supreme Court shall not, in this case, on this section we're talking about, in the very next one, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court shall. I wonder, here we are, the legislative branch telling the judicial branch, you shall. Is that something, maybe staff can comment on that. Is that something we routinely do? I just wonder about the constitutionality of our doing so.
Charles Swenson.
Yeah. Jim Swenson again. Certainly the separation of powers doctrine is one with which we're acutely aware, and it's not one that we raise very often, to say the least. You know, we can make a decision from a judicial branch whether or not that separation of powers is implicated. We don't have a problem with line 210B. We've been working under that, and we're willing to move ahead with that as we have the last 2 years. I would leave to others to comment on whether or not we should invoke the separation of powers doctrine. That would be people at a higher pay grade than me. But I realize that's a potential issue out there, but it's not one that we've chosen to invoke.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thank you, and I... Well, we're in an interesting situation here with regard to this. I mean, each of us, I think, each of us takes an oath to support the Constitution of the state. As legislators, we have the obligation only to vote for things that we believe are constitutional and to not vote for things that we believe are unconstitutional. And so I realize that if this were passed at some point through the process, it could be challenged, or more likely the court would just could just ignore it and there would be no enforcement of it as against the judicial branch. But I think it's important for us as legislators to know what we're voting on, and it just seems to me, you know, if we routinely do this and it's been upheld somewhere or nobody's challenged it, I guess I'd like to know that. But it's just very striking to me that we're telling the Supreme Court how to conduct its business here.
Ms. Spirius.
Mr. Chair and members, with respect to 2.10, in section 2.722 of the statute, the legislature already outlines how to determine a judicial vacancy. So I feel like this is in line with that authority. As for 2.18 in the study, I think the legislature has kind of gone back and forth between using shall and may. And as the judge said, you know, they could probably not do it.
Mr. Chairman.
Judge Knutson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, Sue DeSalle informs me that the language that has been used sometimes in the past is the Supreme Court has requested to do this or to do that. And so that's how we, I think the legislature's got around it in the past, although I the language in 2.10 might be existing language. Not sure.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the language in 2.10, to my knowledge, was used back in 2009, and I don't know of any challenges to it. I don't know if it was used before that. I only recall 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Maylene.
Yes, Judge, Mr. Chair, Judge Swenson, I just wanted to follow up a little bit when we were talking about the vacancies, and you mentioned outstate Minnesota, and I represent a district in greater Minnesota. We've sort of never appreciated the term outstate, but I represent Hibbing, where we only have two judges on the bench, and the next closest judges in the same judicial district would be Virginia, which is 25 miles away, and then Duluth, which is 70 miles away. So you were talking about sort of being able to fill these spots by bringing in judges from, you know, surrounding districts, but that's not so easy for us when we have judges that have to travel a long ways in order to cover vacant spots. So I'm wondering specifically how this is going to affect greater Minnesota when these vacancies cannot be filled and when judges are having to travel from a long distance in order to handle cases.
Judge Swenson.
Yes. I'm not the one who talked about moving judges in between counties and district. That was Judge Knutson. I happen to be the chief judge of a one-county district, so I don't have any experience in that regard.
But
Judge Knutson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we've viewed this as somewhat flexible and looked at the needs of the specific districts that when the vacancies do come up. We've taken the language seriously and looked at other alternatives, but when there's a tremendous need and there's cases that are backing up and we can't afford to have a judge missing or that district, those Duluth judges don't come up to Hibbing or can't come up on a regular basis, we've made other arrangements and perhaps moved the certification up. So.
Representative Maylene.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Judge Knutson. If I just could just follow up a little bit, because, you know, like I was saying, when we only do have two judges, and oftentimes in small communities, judges have to recuse themselves because they know the parties or they've worked on the case previously, there's some sort of conflict of interest. And we have had a lot of issues where, you know, we're having to bring judges in from many miles away, Duluth and Virginia, in the middle of winter, and it does cause a lot of problems for us, and then their calendars where they're usually benched are getting backed up too. So I guess I just have concerns if this is going to impact greater Minnesota more than the rest of the state with these vacancies not being able to be filled. And that's just a final comment more than a question.
Very good. Anyone wishing to testify on Article 2 of the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry about going back to Article 1 here, but I think that it should be pointed out if folks in the audience aren't aware that in Article 1, Section 13, there is a salary freeze, and also there is an interference, in my opinion, with the collective bargaining agreements in Paragraph B. As well as a capping of the mileage reimbursement, which are usually all taken care of in the collective bargaining process. So, Mr. Chair, I was surprised to see an interference with collective bargaining in this bill, but I just wanted to make certain that folks understand that it is in the bill.
Article 2. Article 3. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Back to Article 2. I'm interested in the no proof of insurance provisions in this section of the bill. Mr. Chair, now that it is going to be taken care of through the mail and the courts may take care of this, my question is for the courts, actually, and if they are going to have someone ensuring that the items that are being presented as proof of insurance are actually valid. For example, I actually do prosecution for some proof of insurance cases, and when the defendant submits to me their proof of insurance, I always call the insurance company to confirm that the insurance is on that particular car and in that particular time frame. The ticket was received on X date and the insurance coverage is from X date to X date. So my question is, who is going to be confirming that, in fact, whatever is submitted is actually valid proof of insurance?
That's Swenson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. I think the proper way to respond to this is we, as a judicial branch, will meet and confer and make a determination from a policy perspective what that required proof of insurance means. And we'll weigh in and debate it.
All right.
Another question on Article 2, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On lines 8.8, this is the expansion of the fee to diversion programs and continuances without prosecution. Mr. Chair, do you know how much in new fees this generates?
Not at this time.
Mr. Chair, will you be getting a fiscal note about that?
Yes.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, moving right along, an additional question about the financials. Subdivision 3, the authorization of the informer pauperis and the fees generated from that provision. Do you know how much money will be generated in fees in subdivision, Section 4, Subdivision 3, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom, we will have that number distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's it for Article 2, Mr. Chair, for me.
Mr. Tuma, Article 3.
Mr. Chairman, members, appreciate your time. I did ask the pages to just hand around a little language. In Article 3, pages 9, lines 9.23, and also on page 11, line 11.34, there's language that's been around this capital for a while, proposed by the public defenders, as they indicate, is to keep them from doing representation in civil matters. But what it specifically does is narrow their representation even in criminal matters. We've experienced at the county level, by the way, my name is John Tuma. I'm with the Minnesota Inter-County Association. I represent essentially county commissioners and county administrators with regards to their efforts in the judicial area. What has been happening over the last two decades is a continual creep back to counties paying for, through your property taxes, representation of indigents in criminal and civil matters. We have had several litigations that have gone to the Supreme Court, and they result simply because our statute is confusing and complicated. The handout that I give you is an example of that. If you do the two changes that I pointed out to you in section Article 3 on pages 9 and also on page 11, the courts will have no discretion and with regards to appointing a public defender, and there'll be a great deal of pressure for the courts to order counties to pay for this representation. It could include criminal matters, for example, appeals and misdemeanor cases, Mr. Chairman. And so we're hoping, as you wisely try to limit the exposure of public defenders to representation in areas that they're not supposed to, you don't inadvertently create a shift or a mandate onto county property taxpayers. And so our fear that these changes, which we understand and are necessary in these difficult budget times, need to be made, you might want to consider some changes. And the changes that I suggest to you is to clarify that counties are no longer responsible. If you see the language that I handed out to you, it should point out to you back in 1990, we started a process where the state took over the representation of public defenders. It was completed about a decade later. It was a very complicated process that required a lot of budgets to be shifted around. That is reflected in this change. You see under 611.27, right now it states county payment responsibility is the title of that section. I challenge you to read that section and find out where counties are responsible to pay anything under that particular statute. It doesn't exist. This is a leftover from the existing statutes where when we used to provide the financial means for public defense. It no longer happens. Unfortunately, there are several cases that have been shifting it onto the county property taxpayers. One of the cases, one of the areas that they cite is subdivision 5 of that statute, where it talks about the original budget of the District Public Defender's Office of January 1, 1990. We litigated this issue and we couldn't find that. We went to the library of your library here. They couldn't find it. We couldn't find it. It wasn't clear exactly who and what they represented at that time. And it's created a lot of confusion. And as you can see, it talks about continual takeover. And it continues to create an exposure for counties when you limit the amount of representation public defenders do. It creates exposure to your property taxpayers. So we would ask for language similar to what's there, indicating that counties shall not be ordered to pay for the representation of criminals. We understand we have some obligations in the statute for representation in civil matters, and we will continue to do that. We understand that we lost the case a couple years ago with regards to CHIPS, and our counties have stepped forward and taken responsibility for representation of adults in CHIPS cases. But as you continue to make these limitations on who can be represented in the criminal courts, there has been a lot of shifting over to county property taxpayers, and we would ask as you move forward to look at thinking about some relief for the county property taxpayers and limiting our exposure in criminal cases. With that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for any questions.
Any questions of the witness? Thank you.
Tell us who you are and go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. And Mr. Chuma did share this language with me just ahead of his presentation. We do have some concerns about this. We understand the county's position on this. But just to give you a little history, because I actually was around when the original language was written, as the state began assuming the costs of public defense, there was a shift or an attempt to shift some of those county responsibilities onto the state, and the legislature was very concerned about that, which is why they included the language that you see stricken in subdivision 5. Also, currently, we're going through a process right now where we're starting to see some other costs that are being shifted to public defense. I testified about this earlier. I don't know if it was here or perhaps in the Senate. Things like now with electronic discovery, some of the costs that go along with discovery, which we are entitled to and have always gotten on paper, for example. Now some of those costs with electronic discovery are going to be shifted to us. We understand that's the route that everybody needs to go, but I think there's a sorting out process here that has to go on. So I think, as Mr. Tuma indicated, there's been some creep. I would say it's more of a sorting out process. And if you are going to do something like this, I guess we would like a chance to sit down and visit with folks to make it more specific and tie it to specific services under 611.14, which is where the services provided by public defense are delineated. So with that, I would stand for whatever questions the members might have.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I have the public defenders there, I don't have a question about this, but I do have a few other questions, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at Article 3 and the public defender pieces, can you tell me what impact this language will have on the caseloads of the public defenders?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, are you referring to the guidelines, the
Representative Hills.
Income guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm talking about all of Article 3 because it says public defenders. Mm-hmm. So there's the general rule about no public defender appointments. There's the request for appointment and the income guidelines. There is the waiver or reimbursement piece. And then there's the flat budget. So I'd like to know what the impact of
this on the public defender's office. There might be.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, with regard to the general language, as we testified earlier, is I think what it does is it removes some of the old language that was in the statutes prior to state assumption, which gave the court some broad authority to appoint in just about any kind of case. Does it happen often? No. Does it happen occasionally? Yes. And I think we've talked about this for a few years here. With regard to the specific eligibility criteria, this was a recommendation that came out of the legislative auditor's report from last year. As we testified earlier, we're not sure what it's going to mean. I think what it does is it gives the court a better tool and a more consistent tool across the state in order that we have more of a, again, a consistent eligibility screening. So what it's going to mean individual county by county, we really don't know at this point.
Mr. Representative
Chair.
Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask the folks from the judiciary a question about this as well?
Sure.
Judge Swenson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you tell me, in the event these new income guidelines are put in place, and do you believe there'll be more pro se parties, or do you believe there'll be fewer pro se parties based on these income guidelines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't have any idea.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the event that it results in more pro se parties, I don't even have to say that. When there are pro se parties, does the judicial branch appoint other kinds of counsel, either PDs and ask the county to pay for it, or someone else, either on a voluntary basis or something else, and then have someone else pay for it other than the PDs?
That's fine. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, are you asking whether or not the judicial branch appoints private lawyers and directs them to represent people who would otherwise be qualified for a public defender?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have seen judges appoint either standby counsel or other folks. And so I guess my question is, when there's a pro se party with a complicated case, either felony, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, is there a practice of appointing someone else and then having either the county pay for it or someone else pay for it, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know what happens throughout the state, but in Hennepin, I know that in certain cases, public defenders have been appointed as standby counsel.
Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would this language prohibit that from happening? Because it says that you can't appoint if someone just refuses to get counsel if they don't meet the income guidelines.
Judge Swenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. The situation that I referred to when we appoint the public defender as standby counsel is when occurs when somebody is qualified but rejects the appointment. Then we appoint a standby to help because of the administration of justice. We need this person to have some help so that we can control the length of the case.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Judge Swenson, I understand that. I guess the question that I want to ask is, based on this income guidelines, I wish I had data that would show me whether there would be more of a need for standby counsel if we're going to have more folks that are not going to be eligible or fewer folks that are not going to be eligible. Because ultimately, I know it's a challenge for the court when there's more pro se litigants. And I guess you just told me that you don't know what these income guidelines and the impact they're going to have.
Representative Maylene, and then Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions were pretty much along the same lines as Representative Hillstrom's, and they're for the Public Defender's Office. And I really would like to know how many Minnesotans are not going to be, under this new language, how many Minnesotans are not going to have representation on misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and felonies. Because I don't see how we could pass this language without knowing that information. And I believe you said that you don't have that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Kier,
we don't.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mailing.
And to the Public Defender's Office, I guess, I just, you know, we know that someone who makes $13,000 a year can't afford their own attorney. And so now under this language, they can't have a public defender either. And we maybe think that misdemeanors aren't that big of a deal, but they are. And people lose their jobs over getting misdemeanors. And people have collateral sanctions for the rest of their lives over having misdemeanors. And the fact that we have this language in a bill and we don't know how many people are going to be falling through the cracks on representation in the courtroom is disturbing to me. And I think that this came up last time that we heard this bill and we asked for some estimates on how many Minnesotans would be falling through the cracks. So it would be nice to see those numbers.
Judge Swenson.
You didn't ask the question of me, but I will just point out subdivision, subsection 4. It says the court still may. You know, we go through a determination of whether somebody has the ability to pay in general, but the guidelines smooth the process or speed it up, but the court always can make a determination that somebody doesn't have the ability.
Representative Mealing.
Yes, and Mr. Chair and Judge Swenson, then under this new language, you know, I would imagine that a lot of people are going to be asking the court to make that determination because, as I stated, I don't think that they're going to be able to afford an attorney on their own. And so how do you think that's going to burden the court even more to have to be going through more people to determine if they can qualify for a public defender even if it isn't under this strict language?
Judge Swenson.
Yeah. I don't know that I have the answer to that, but I will say that right now people apply and the court ultimately has to make a determination. But from the outside looking in, and I haven't evaluated these, but these guidelines, for example, would fit very well with the new kiosks that Hennepin County is putting in all of its criminal courts for people to plug in the data and to attempt to qualify. And what that does through the kiosk is it saves significant employee time at the counter from having to deal with the helping people fill out the forms in order to get it to the court for the judicial determination. So I suppose it's possible that there might be more court time, but on the front end, we save lots of employee time. And right now, we have many open positions in Hennepin County, and we need to save dollars on the employee side as well as on the court side, the judge side.
Representative Mealy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Judge Swenson. If I could just follow up on that a little bit. So are you saying that that this determination of whether or not someone qualifies, if they don't qualify by the strict language, would be made sort of through an electronic kiosk instead of through the court system?
No, the kiosk, as we proposed it in Hennepin, would make the initial determination to see whether they qualify under whatever guidelines we would put in the kiosk. You know, we could do our own, or we could input these guidelines theoretically, and then that would determine, in other words, give somebody a green light that they qualify, and that eliminates the counter and employee involvement. But if somebody didn't get the green light from the kiosk, then they would always have the ability to ask the court, and the court would then determine of its own volition whether or not, because of a dearth of assets and means, the person should still be entitled and, in effect, override the default position.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have concerns about this as well. And first of all, we spend a lot of time in this committee talking about how the public defender is necessary for the smooth functioning of the courts and the ecosystem that we have in our court system. And Mr. Kyer is smiling. I think this is your word, and I think it's a great way to understand how our court system works. All the parts have to function for the whole to function. And we're talking here about, you know, possibly restricting the number of judges and so on. And the critical restriction, I think, right now is in the public defender. So I'm concerned about the language on line 11.26 to 11.29. So along with these guidelines that we've been discussing, we have this language that the court shall not appoint a public defender to a defendant who's financially able to retain counsel but refuses to do so, etc. Now, Judge Swenson, you were talking about standby counsel. In cases where, in my experience, the court sometimes will appoint the public defender to somebody who doesn't even want the public defender because it helps the work of the courts. Because when you've got somebody, especially in a big case, you're just asking for problems. If that person, say, maybe they are eligible for public defender, but they don't want to fill out the form, they don't want the public defender, they want to represent themselves, but in fact they can cause a lot of problems in the court system because they don't know what the heck they're doing, and they cause a lot of slowdown, and of course then they are quite possibly going to have appellate issues. So I'm wondering if this language would prevent the court from appointing standby counsel in that case, appointing the public defender. And I don't know if Judge Swenson, if you want to answer that, or Mr. Kyer, but it just seems to me that we might be kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face here by restricting public defenders and their ability to represent people.
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Legan, just to clarify, it is not a practice in Greater Minnesota that we represent folks on standby counsel. And if that's not correct, I'm sure one of my folks will correct me when I get back to the office. But we had this discussion in this committee several years ago, and we basically got out of that business with the theory that if somebody didn't want us there, you know, that's not something we should be providing. In Hennepin County, it does, and it does, if we've talked to this committee, is the county provides substantial contribution to run the public defender office there. So there are different ways of doing business in Hennepin than there are in the other judicial districts, and for good reason. I mean, for this year, I think that total is about over $7 million that they're providing to run that office. With respect to, you know, whether or not, you know, having more pro se litigants and how that impacts the court, I guess I defer to Judge Swenson on that. But I just wanted to make that clarification.
Before the chair entertains any more questions, is there anyone who wants to be heard on this, excuse me, this Article 3 in the audience? Anyone wanting to testify on Article 4? All right, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, could I just finish?
Sure, go
thank
ahead.
You.
Representative Lupin.
I think Judge Swenson might have wanted to say something with regard to that, and I certainly wanted him to answer the question as well, whether this language is going to create a problem for the courts because of the inability to appoint standby counsel in the appropriate case.
Okay, my answer to that would be it could be problematic, but and it's shall not appoint a public defender, and we couldn't appoint a public defender if the person didn't pass the financial means in the first place. So you were talking about, on a more global basis, people who come into court and are problematic, and would we love to be able to appoint somebody to help them for the administration of justice? Of course. I understand that they do that in the federal arena. I haven't looked at it or talked to my colleagues about the ability to do that at a state level.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Judge Swenson. And then I guess the flip side of that would be, is this language going to save anything then? I mean, it sounds like if the courts aren't doing this anyway, you know, is this just kind of putting on suspenders with the belt.
I haven't participated in any fiscal notes, so I don't know what the if you've asked for one, whether we've given you one, and what the numbers have been. I didn't partake in that discussion. I do not know off the top of my head how many times in Hennepin County we appoint a standby attorney. I just don't know. I know that it happens on occasion because I hear about it. I don't know the number of such cases that would be impacted, quite frankly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, will there be a fiscal note, or is this included anywhere in any fiscal note that we have?
It'll be distributed.
Thank you.
Judge Swenson, does a defendant have a right to self-representation?
Representative or Chair Smith, as I understand it, that idea is being played out in the federal courts as we speak. I think I remember seeing that the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on that, but I haven't read the opinion. That's a dicey legal issue, and they're both sides of the argument. I mean, I don't know how that's going to finally be resolved by the highest court, but I know that that's something that's debated within the legal profession quite often.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a final question. So on page 10 of the bill, I think it's subsection 4, we've been talking about that the court can decide, even based on these guidelines, that the court can decide that someone should be appointed. So if the person doesn't meet the income guidelines that we put forward in this bill, who pays for the appointment of the counsel?
Judge Swenson.
Under the current scenario, if a person doesn't meet the guides and the judge exercises his or her discretion to appoint a public defender because we determine the person doesn't have the financial wherewithal, it would be a public defender who's already funded as part of the public defender budget.
Mr. Chair.
It's not an a third party that we bring in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under these new rules, would that be the same?
Say again?
Mr. Chair, under this new proposed language, would that be the same? Would it still be paid for through the public defenders?
Yes.
Okay.
Any other testimony? Any other questions? Gentlemen, judges, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one last question? Are we done with Article 4 and 5 and everything?
Yes.
I just have one final question. Also,
Representative Hilstrom, ask away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 18.13, that starts the section about the minimum assessment. Will you have a fiscal note on how much this fee generates to your budget line, Mr. Chair?
Representative Hilstrom, yes.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is the, I know you haven't even moved your amendment here, but, you know, I just want to make a comment, though, about the bill that we've been hearing here today. And since we have a couple of minutes left, Mr. Chair, a lot of rhetoric was used, especially in the last election, about we have a spending problem in the state and not a revenue problem. And I think that this bill kind of gives the lie to that. Now, I know that you have a target here and that it's not entirely of your making, Mr. Chair, and I know that you have great concern about the legal system, so this is in no way a personal comment, but I think it needs to be said that what this bill does is rob Peter to pay Paul. I think it sets some very bad priorities, First of all, it makes cuts to vulnerable kids through the guardian ad litem cuts, which we heard about today. I'm very concerned about that, especially because in Health and Human Services we're going to be making those kinds of cuts as well. It does not properly fund the public defender and tries to get around some of that by restricting when public defenders can be appointed and so on, which I think just adds to the burdens of our courts, which we are still not funding adequately. So we're cutting here, there, and everywhere. And finally, I'm very concerned about the cuts to civil legal services, which I believe are entirely unwarranted. I think this, again, puts an additional burden on the court. We are not funding adequately one of the most important functions of government, and I think that is very concerning. Basically, what we're doing here in many of these areas, we've been hearing about possibly shifting more costs to the counties, which, of course, we're doing in other areas of the budget, particularly in Health and Human Services. I think we're going to see a lot about that we're shifting more costs to counties when we refuse to fund them at the state level. Basically, I believe all that does is pretend that we don't have to have any more revenue, and then we just pass it to the counties who have to raise their revenue through the property taxes, which are less fair and less transparent than doing it at the state level. And I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair. I know we're going to have more discussion about this bill, but I think that it needs to be said that, at least in my view, that there are some bad priorities set here, not just by this committee, but in terms of our overall budget. I think this is very unfortunate that we cannot properly fund this very core function of government.
Anyone else? Next meeting, Thursday morning, 8:15.
We're adjourned.